Today I want to talk about a word that I guess has a lot of theological baggage to it, but it's an important word, and it's basically the sovereignty of God. It's been a matter for a lot of intense theological discussion over the centuries. Think of sovereignty basically as the supremacy to rule without interference or guidance from anyone else. Essentially, God needs no one else to help him rule, and he answers to no one. His power is absolute and complete. He doesn't need anybody else to tell him what to do. From Augustine to Calvin to contemporary theologians, despite our differences in how we apply it and what we do with it, all people agree that God possesses that kind of authority. He possesses the rule to govern everything in his own way. Okay? Nobody disagrees with that part. But you see, the struggle for control and power has really been with humanity ever since the fall. That's really what the fall was all about. We take the control for ourselves. We don't think God's way of doing it is the right way. We want to do it our way. Now, there's a whole lot in there. You know, we've been deceived. Eve was deceived and everything. But that's the essence of it. We challenge the authority and power of God, his sovereignty, to say what's right and wrong. And Satan encourages us to elevate our desires and our wishes over his. That's the human condition. I believe peace and freedom, however, can only be found when we submit to God's will. And there's a great paradox there, isn't there? Submitting to God brings freedom. But in fact, it does. And so the first thing that we need to think about when we consider the sovereignty of God, when we think about it as applying to ourselves personally, is this. Number one, we have to acknowledge that he is sovereign. We have to admit it. We have to accept the fact that he is the sovereign ruler over everything. The Psalms passage that was read this morning, Psalm 104, verses 1 through 9, recognizes that the God that we serve is the creator and sustainer of the universe. And think about that. All the beauty you see around you, all the things of nature that happen, they're under God's control. They're not under anybody else's. I know we talk about nature being Mother Nature, but that's just kind of a sort of weak metaphor in a way, because it's not Mother, it's Father. God's the one that's in charge of all of that. And he's the one that makes it happen. He's the one that gives us our food. He's the one that causes good or bad things to happen. God's answer to Job when Job challenged his authority was really very simple. Where were you when I laid the foundation of the earth? Tell me if you know how I did that. Job had to kind of shrink and like, oh, yeah, well, I hadn't thought of it that way, you know. But in a way, we sort of do that, you know. And the challenge of idolatry among the Israelites was a matter of who controlled the elements. Their neighbors believed that there were Baals and Ashtoreths and all these other gods you had to sacrifice to them. And sometimes you even had to sacrifice your own children to them, which is abhorrent to us. But it's what they did. I don't know how often they did it, but they felt like these other gods were in control of nature. And that was part of the struggle. Who brought forth the crops for them? Who protected them from disasters? Who could save them from the hand of their enemies? The Israelites had, or the prophets at least, kept saying, guys, don't forget, it's the Lord God who brought you out of Egypt who does all these things for you. And God's will, as it begins to be unfolded more and more and more throughout the Old Testament, becomes very clear that God's will was focused on salvation. This whole notion of redemption. God was the God who redeemed people. In Isaiah chapter 53 and verse 10, we're told by Isaiah that it was God's will to crush him, meaning the Messiah, meaning Jesus. That was God's will. That was God's desire. And his determined effort to do that was the plan, that he was going to do that. Isaiah also says in that same passage that God's will would prosper under his guiding hand. So it was God's sovereign will, it was God's plan that these things take place. And under the Messiah, whom we know to be Jesus, of course, that will was going to prosper. That was going to come to the forefront and be so much a part of just who he was. Did not Jesus himself acknowledge that control of life belonged to God? Again, the passage that was read when the disciples came to Jesus and said, look, we want one of us to sit on your right hand and one of us on your left. What does Jesus tell them? He says, well, you know, it's not for me to determine that. That's already been determined and prepared. You see, he was acknowledging God's sovereign will in all of that. And it was very important for the disciples to know that was even out of his hands to do that. So Jesus himself said also in the garden, did he not? Not my will, but yours be done. Jesus was the greatest example of leaving things to God's sovereign will. Furthermore, he didn't even appoint himself to be the priest. He allowed that was God's decision to appoint himself to be the priest. Hebrews chapter 5 and verse 4 says, no one takes that priesthood upon himself. It says they just don't do that. It's not for them to determine that. And that was one of the problems also in the Old Testament. As we've been reading through the books of 1 and 2 Kings on Wednesday nights, we found out that one of the things that happened when Israel turned to idolatry was they began to appoint anybody who wanted to be a priest to be a priest. And, you know, I mean, that was sort of only a secondary step, I guess, in just making all these other gods as gods. But it was one of those things where we begin taking more and more authority upon ourselves. Jeroboam, when he first splits off from the southern tribes and from Jerusalem, that's one of the first things he does. Besides setting up the golden calf, he says, okay, I need some priests here. Who am I going to get? So let's just go, we'll just appoint somebody. In Hebrews chapter 5 and verse 5, it says Jesus was appointed by God. Paul's ministry, we keep going through this in 2 Corinthians in the morning. He keeps saying to say, this is God's ministry. The ministry of reconciliation, that's from God. It's not something we devised ourselves. It's not something we give by our own authority to do these things. It's something that God himself has appointed. We believe that. We have to acknowledge that. And Jesus' appointment as priest becomes very clear when you begin to examine his life. The miracles, certainly the resurrection, the power and presence of God are apparent if our eyes are open to really seeing it. And so when we begin to think about the sovereignty of God, it's the most important thing for us human beings to determine is, do we acknowledge it? Do we say, yep, I don't have complete control of my life? You know, you don't have to live very long before you realize I'm not in complete control anyway. You know, there are things that happen to us that are out of our control. And whether or not that's God doing it, you know, it's not even that important to determine that at that point. It's just a matter of saying, well, who's going to control my life? What control do I have in my life? Okay? How much do I take control of my life and forget about God? And how much do I take control of my life within the realm of God's sovereign will? That's the question that we as human beings have to keep facing. That's the challenge of the message of the gospel to other people. Are you going to acknowledge the sovereignty of God? And I think one of the things, perhaps, is the next step is, okay, once I acknowledge it, do I surrender to it? Jesus tells a very interesting parable, interesting to me at least, in Luke chapter 14, verses 31 through 33. I don't think it's one we talk about a whole lot. But Jesus is talking in that context about becoming a disciple. And he asks people to think about what happens when a king goes to war. And a king comes up against him who's bigger, stronger, faster, and whatever. You know, you walk out on the field of battle and they're all bigger. You know, if you ever played sports, you felt that intimidation factor. Well, they're all bigger than us. He's got twice as many men. And Jesus said, well, you know what? He takes a look at the situation. He says, I'm going to lose. I think I'd rather live than just be completely destroyed. So he goes out and he negotiates terms of surrender, whether it's, you know, unconditional or some other terms. I get to live. And Jesus is using that parable about, okay, you know, you want to challenge God's sovereignty? You know what? You're going to lose. Jesus, or God has, at the very least, twice the amount of power that you do. So, you know, you can't win that. The gospel calls us to accept the authority of God and the authority of Jesus Christ. Islam claims the will of God is revealed in the words of Muhammad. For the most part, a lot of secular Western people in society, you know what we accept? We accept our sovereign selves as the final arbiter of right and wrong. We falsely claim that we ourselves have the final say on morality and lifestyle. We've basically enthroned what some call the sovereign self. We're it. We can decide for ourselves what we do. We can decide for ourselves what's right and wrong. We can decide for ourselves who we are and what we're going to be. And there are a number of problems with that that people really don't want to stop to think about, not the least of which is it assumes we know exactly what we want. We don't always know exactly what we want. Our feelings can be mixed, maybe even a little incoherent. Another problem with it is we cannot truly, and the phrase we often use, that we cannot become ourselves beyond any external valuations. You know, looking inside to find out who we are, well, what's inside? It's kind of a mixture. You know, it really is probably kind of an illusion. We don't get our full and final identity by looking within, because that's not the only thing that defines who we are. We're shaped by a lot of other forces. Think about it. We don't even get to choose who our parents are. From the very get-go, we don't get to choose that. We don't, at least for a time, don't get to choose the communities where we grow up in that provide the influences in our lives. Maybe later as we grow up and get a little older, we can do some of that. But the fact is, we're shaped by things that are already out of our control from the very beginning of our lives. We really need some external things to help sort out all the warring impulses within us. Paul and the other New Testament writers try to tell us that over and over again. We got all these impulses. There's a war going on inside. One says this, one says that. We don't know what to do. We're struggling with our own sins and our own impulses. So to try to say that our sovereign selves are the final arbiter of right and wrong, we're not surprised that it comes out mixed and messed up, okay? The one thing that we have to do first and foremost, again, is surrender to the will of God. We have to admit the truth about God, that He will determine the morality and the lifestyle of just who we are as human beings. I read the story recently, an article. I hadn't read the book, but I read an article about a guy by the name of Mike Minot, M-I-N-O-T. I'm assuming that's how it's pronounced. He's a former atheist turned Christian. He was challenged by a friend of his to rethink his atheism. Guy just called him up one day and said, you know, I want you to start thinking about something. He knew Mike was an atheist. He knew he was a fairly well-accomplished lawyer at the time that he tried to have this discussion with him. And so Mike took the challenge and he began to read. And he began to read all the things he could about why people believe in God. Why it might make sense, why even scientifically it points to some kind of creative intelligence behind the universe. And he began to realize that, you know, the way I believed things wasn't quite as rational and believable as the way they're telling me I ought to believe about God. It kind of makes sense, this whole, naturalism, where everything is controlled by natural forces and we're just a compilation of chemical processes in our brains and in our bodies. After a while, that doesn't fit, doesn't really make sense with what I see. He couldn't deny what he was reading. In reality, he came to believe that a creator exists. And he began to see that that creator was the creator who said in the Bible, I've sent my son Jesus Christ to die for you. He wrote a book about it. Again, I haven't read the book, but if any of you are readers, which I hope you are, you like to read things. He wrote a book called The Beckoning, examining the truth that transformed an atheist attorney into a believer in God. All the reasons he gives now for why he believes. But it started with does God exist? Why should I believe that God exists? Why should I believe there is a sovereign creator and ruler over all things? According to him, I think he's right. It's a belief that kind of beckons us. It calls us to itself. And it calls us in a way that's kind of unique in religion. It calls us with love. It calls us with, you know, the fact that he sent his son to die for us. But it certainly calls us to hear the message of God. It calls us to hear the words of God after we've come to realize he's there. Well, what does he say? I said this a couple weeks ago, and I still think it's really unique. God talks to us. In fact, God invites us into his presence. He invites us into dialogue with him. Come, let us reason together, Isaiah tells the Israelites. God wants to get us in conversation. He wants to get us in relationship with himself. And so he does that for us. Part of the message he wants to tell us is some of it that's not terribly attractive. And that is simply the ugliness of human nature. Jesus says in John 8, verses 32 to 34, you will know the truth and the truth will set you free. And the truth is simply, you're slaves to sin. You have to come to grips with that. That's part of the message. It's a part of being truthful. It's a part of looking at what God says. It's a part of recognizing that there's something going on here and God's speaking to me. That God who is sovereign, that God who created everything, you know what? He's talking to me. He wants me to know about himself. He wants me to know about myself. He wants me to know that if I try to have control over my own life, it's going to be a mess. Which, you know, look around. It is a mess. Our lives get messed up because we keep listening to ourselves and not listening to God. I'd like to think that the final step we take after recognizing the sovereignty of God and after surrendering to the sovereignty of God is even taking delight in the sovereignty of God. You know, we don't want our... I don't know that anybody wants their life to be a joyless existence. And it's sometimes one of the things people criticize Christianity for, usually people who don't really know Christianity. The fact is, we can delight in God's sovereign rule because God's sovereign will defines our way of life for us, and it kind of gives us a kind of freedom that we wouldn't have otherwise. You know, it's funny, I listen to commercials, I listen to things on the radio all the time, and I hear things like, well, if you buy our phone plan, you can not have any limits. You know, not having limits is important. And a phone plan, I suppose it's okay. But it's sort of an appeal to our own sovereign selves that we don't want any limits. The whole notion of not having limits sounds kind of good because I get to do whatever I want. Well, again, in a phone plan, that's probably okay to not have limits. You're still going to have them whether you think it or not, but that's another whole matter. But you see, once we believe in a supreme being, we realize there are some limits, but within those limits, good things happen. We believe that Jesus Christ reveals the living God, creator of heaven and earth. And the morality he reveals becomes a foundation for living that comes from a source outside of ourselves. But once those limits are put in place, we look around and we go, you know what? There's a certain freedom that I have as an individual to express my life according to those rules, according to those boundaries and limits. And anybody who's had kids, and that's most of us, deal with kids. You know, kids really need the limits. They'll fight them. They'll go crazy over them. But at some point, they realize, you know what? That my parents were kind of right. I know, a lot of times, you know, in certain points, no, they're not. That's how we generally think. But you live long enough and you realize everybody's going to have some limits on them. Why not take the limits that were given to us by God? And it's God who gives them. When God gave the Ten Commandments to Moses, remember the introduction to those Ten Commandments was something like, I am the God who brought you out of the land of Egypt. His very nature, who he was, provides the foundation for those limitations and for those guidelines and that way of life that he was trying to define for us. Paul says in 2 Corinthians, we are new creations. We have a new life. Once you begin to see that elevating your sovereign self above everything else has done nothing but destroy your life, which it will eventually. It doesn't feel that way at first. It feels good to be that kind of free, not to have anybody tell you what to do. But as soon as you begin to realize that that life has destroyed me, you come back and you realize that there's a way I can be a new creation. And that's only through Jesus Christ. The purpose and meaning of our lives are now defined for us by the purpose and meaning given to us as Christian people, as people who identify with Jesus Christ, as people who identify with the way of life that is defined by Jesus Christ. Doesn't the resurrection draw us forward with hope by giving us a vision of life beyond the grave? Isn't there something you can delight in about that? Isn't there something you can delight in about the beauty of the relationships that we're told to have within the church, within our close friendships, between our spouses, with our husbands, our wives? There's a beauty that's kind of, to me, self-authenticating once you really begin to put it into practice. And it's when you do that, that's when you begin to delight in the will of God. When you see that it does something really good, but you have to put it into practice before you can learn to delight in it. They provide the foundation for living faithfully under the sovereign rule of God. It's not limiting, it's freeing. It's a paradox, of course, because we're putting ourselves under someone else's rule, but when we do that, then do we really experience the freedom to become what a human being is supposed to be. Mike Minow expressed it well, I think, when he said, "No one's actions can either create or discredit the truth about whether God exists. God exists or doesn't exist, independently of the actions of any person. God's out there. Whether I'm a hypocrite, whether I don't live the life fully or not, whether somebody else is not as good as they ought to be, it really doesn't matter in terms of the facts of God's existence. He's there. Whether people admit it or not, we're all bound by this rule." But my encouragement this morning is for all of us, those of us who have already named the name of Christ, those of us who maybe haven't done so yet, maybe those of us who are struggling a little bit with our faith to put it all into practice and to live that life fully, continue to acknowledge that God is sovereign and He's the one in charge of the entire universe. Surrender to it. Don't feel like surrendering to it is a loss of your freedom. It's a gaining of freedom in a way that you didn't have when you kept rebelling. Learn to take delight in it. Find the joy in your Christian life. Rather a God of love and mercy than one of cruelty and judgment, don't you think? Wouldn't you rather submit to that? Wouldn't you rather submit to a God who really cares? I know sometimes you may not always feel that way. You wonder where He is, but He's still there. He's still there because we know about the cross and we know that we participate in His death and resurrection and reminders of that every week. We know He loves us because He's forgiven us and calls us to Himself. Allow yourself this week to be blessed by living under the sovereignty of God.